Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really complex fantasy narrative. It's all about identity, loyalty, or the lack of it, and some seriously dangerous weaponized magic.
Absolutely. We've got a lot of source material here, charting what starts as, you know, a seemingly straightforward mission, but spirals into this massive conflict involving disgraced knights, assassins, artifacts, the works.
Our goal is to kind of streamline this intricate plot for you. So let's focus on the mission itself. We have the central figures, Lisette and Ginevra, hired by Bishop Pileggi to retrieve an artifact, the Lotus.
Right. And these two characters couldn't be more different. Lisette is a former Knight of Corlie.
Former being the key word. She carries a lot of baggage.
She really does.
Yeah.
Banished for supposedly murdering Baron Roland. But the sources make it crystal clear it was self-defense.
But her ex-lover, Baroness Maurice, saw a political angle.
Exactly. Maurice framed her, spun the story, got Lisette banished. Political maneuvering, pure and simple. Lisette's honor was basically collateral damage.
So she's adrift, taking jobs like this one. And her partner, Ginevra.
Oh, Ginevra. She's the complete opposite. A Nevaeh assassin, part of the Amon clan. If Lisette is struggling with lost honor, Ginevra is all about cold, hard results.
How results-oriented are we talking?
Well, the texts mention her main performance metric is how many humans she's gutted lately. She was apparently disappointed 1 week because she only got 10.
Okay, so practical, literal-minded, ruthless.
You got it. For her, this mission is just a job, a transaction.
So Bishop Pileggi deliberately pairs these two, the knight desperate for honor and the assassin who doesn't even grasp the concept, to get this artifact, the Lotus.
Yep. And the Lotus itself, it's the catalyst for everything. It's described as this metal flower, right, designed to hold a gem.
Not just any gem, though. This thing sounds volatile.
Extremely.
Mm-hmm.
The sources say the gem alone, before it was properly contained in the Lotus, caused half a building to basically shake apart. It's concentrated, unstable power. Pileggi claims he needs it. Urgently.
And where does one buy an incredibly dangerous building-shaking artifact?
Apparently, it was sold to the Wizard's Glade in Kletby. Which sounds grand, but Kletby itself is fascinatingly deceptive.
How so?
It presents itself as this charming little village, famous for its wine, attracts tourists.
It's nice.
But it's a total facade. The wine, it's actually brought in secretly from somewhere else. The whole village is a front.
A front for what?
For sorcerers. It's essentially a hidden, well-protected enclave for magic users, hiding in plain sight behind bad wine.
That's brilliant, actually, hiding behind mediocre imports, but not hidden enough for Lisette and Ginevra.
Well, let's just say the security wasn't exactly state-of-the-art.
Mm.
The Lotus was being guarded by an apprentice, Rui Taj.
An apprentice?
Illusionist apprentice, yeah.
Yeah.
His boss, Headmaster Zviad, had popped off to a gosset through a portal, leaving Rui in charge. Big mistake.
Why? What did Rui do or not do?
Rui's easily distracted. Apparently more interested in flirting than guarding priceless artifacts.
Lisette and Ginevra sneak in, and they literally find him asleep. Snoring.
Snoring! You can't make this stuff up! So they grab the gem easily. But the interesting thing about Rui, beyond his napping habits, is a specific weakness the sources highlight. He can't reliably make portals.
Okay, why is that important? Seems like a personal failing.
It becomes critical later. In a world where powerful people can just zip across continents via portal, having a mage on your team who can't do that reliably, that's a major tactical disadvantage. It keeps things grounded, messy.
Right, grounds the magic in reality. Okay, so heist complete, gem acquired. But this was all for Bishop Pileggi. Let's pivot to what he was really up to back at the Citadel de la Sarlacc.
Yeah, this is where it shifts from like a stealth mission to something much darker. Pileggi wasn't just funding research. He was developing the locum vulnerarium.
Which translates to?
Basically, living armor.
Yeah.
Constructs. His dream was these invincible, tireless soldiers powered by magic. Perfect defenders against the Emon, the Sabbat, whoever. No fear, no weakness.
The classic quest for the perfect soldier, which usually goes wrong. They don't go wrong here.
Horrifically wrong. And right away, the initial tests were disastrous. One crusader, Erskine, nearly incinerated inside the suit.
Oh, wow.
Another one, Leon, put on a suit, became incredibly aggressive, and then literally just burned up, died from the inside out.
And Pileggi's response, shut it down.
Nope. Covered it up, treated these deaths as, you know, acceptable losses.
Yeah.
Just pushed ahead with the project.
That's chilling. And this brings us to Captain Gauvain. He commands a unit of these constructs.
He does. And he sees their effectiveness firsthand during a raid on bandits. In a town called Strack. They wipe out the bandits, no problem. Mechanically efficient.
There's always a but.
but they're indiscriminate. They kill two innocent civilians in the process. The parents of a little boy named Emile. Gauvain, who's a deeply honorable soldier, is appalled. He sees the lack of control, the absence of any kind of morality.
So this forces his hand. What does he do?
Well, one of the construct suits malfunctions. And Gauvain, instead of, you know, calling tech support, decides to prove a point. He believes a real soldier, someone with discipline and will, can control the armor, override its flaws. So he puts the malfunctioning suit on himself.
Oh, I have a bad feeling about this.
You should. The moment he puts it on, the armor corrupts him. Instantaneously. He's flooded with this uncontrollable rage, this constant painful tingling sensation. The armor doesn't obey him, it consumes him.
So the ideal soldier becomes the monster he feared.
Precisely. And when Lysette's group eventually confronts him in Strag, he's completely lost to the armor's influence.
How does that end?
Tragically and very symbolically. He tries to tear his White Guard emblem off the armor's chest plate, like trying to reclaim his identity, his loyalty. The moment he touches the emblem, he's incinerated, just gone. The armor rejects the very symbol of the honor it destroyed. It's a powerful visual. The tech literally erasing the soldier's identity.
Wow. Okay, so that's a huge turning point. Proof positive that Pelagie's project isn't just flawed, it's actively malevolent. This has to broaden the scope, right?
It absolutely does. The threat is clearly bigger than just rogue armor. And this leads us into the next phase, where the conflict really extends beyond just Olshier's borders.
Who else gets pulled into this?
We meet Desbarreaux. He's a servant on Anoroth, basically a healer, but also a dreamwalker. He has this deep connection to the natural world.
And his dreams are showing him.
Catastrophe. A world-ending calamity, something elemental and vast, much bigger than Pelagie's constructs, or so it seems at first.
How does he connect this to Pelagie, though? Or the Lotus?
Through direct experience. His own village, Daewon, which is usually peaceful, gets attacked by Amblis.
Amblis, what are they?
They're normally harmless plant creatures, passive. But suddenly they turn violent, aggressive. Desbarreaux is convinced they're being corrupted by the same dark energy he's seeing in his visions.
So Pelagie's project, maybe fueled by the Lotus, isn't just creating killer robots. It's somehow poisoning the natural world itself, unleashing something primal.
That's the terrifying implication. It's tapping into or maybe causing this massive elemental imbalance. The stakes just got exponentially higher.
So the team needs backup, and the allies they gather are unexpected, to say the least.
Definitely. You've got Lysette the Disgraced Knight, Ginevra the Assassin, Desbarreaux the Healer, and then Vicen shows up.
The Zin is?
A silver dragon.
Okay, a literal dragon.
Yep, who uses transmogrification, not just illusion, like a genuine physical transformation to appear human. He communicates telepathically.
How does a dragon fit in with an assassin and a knight?
He's initially quite naive about conflict, about human plotting and all that, but he's inherently protective. He sees the corrupted Amblis attacking, sees the group in danger, and just joins in, defends them, fire breath and all.
The visual of a dragon fighting corrupted plants alongside an assassin.
Yeah, that definitely raises the stakes. And then guess who else arrives?
Let me guess. Our favorite sleepy guard, Rui Targe.
The very same. He tracks him down.
Still mortified by his failure back at the Glade, I imagine. Desperate to prove himself useful, maybe. Seems likely. And what's amazing here is how this imminent threat just bulldozes all the existing tensions.
Right. You've got the assassin, the dragon, the healer, the failed apprentice mage, the banished knight, all suddenly on the same page. They figure it out.
Figure what out?
The Lotus. It has to be the source. Pelagie's ambition, the corrupted armor, the enraged Amblis, Desbarreaux's visions, it all connects back to that artifact he's using. The enemy isn't a nation or a race, it's this unchecked power.
So Lysette's mission changed drastically from get the shiny flower to stop the apocalypse. How does she tackle that?
She decides to go right to the source, back to the Citadel.
Yeah.
But not as an outlaw.
Oh. How does she go back?
In a major turn for her character arc, she gets commissioned. She's made the new Captain Sabbat of the White Guard.
Wow, reclaims her status.
Exactly. And she immediately plans to use that authority, that institutional power, to shut Pelagie's lab down, restore the guard's honor by cleaning house.
Does Pelagie just roll over when the new captain shows up?
Not quite. The confrontation happens, but it's not about rank. It's about power. Pelagie finally drops the whole pious bishop act.
Reveals his true colors.
Completely.
Yeah.
He talks about achieving complete dominance over the lesser inhabitants of Adia. The language strongly suggests he might not even be human. He's wielding the Lotus, which is now fashioned into a scepter, amplifying his power.
And he goes after Lysette directly.
Brutally and personally. First, he somehow strips away her own protective armor, the very thing that had been healing her throughout her journey. It's psychological. Then he strikes.
How?
With a spiked claw, described as non-human. Hits her right in the chest. It's a mortal wound.
No, after everything.
Yeah, it's the final cost of her quest for honor. She stood up to him and paid the ultimate price.
What happens then? Chaos.
Total chaos.
Yeah.
Ginevra, Vazen, Dabaro, they're fighting off the remaining Locum Varnarium constructs while trying to grab the Lotus Scepter.
Do they get it? Do they escape?
They do. Ginevra manages to snatch the scepter. Vazen helps get them out along with the dying Lisette. Dabaro tries to heal her. But the sources are specific. He can heal wounds, but he says he can't restore life force. Lisette dies.
But her death isn't meaningless, is it? It shifts things.
Profoundly. Her life started in disgrace, banished. It ends with her defending the realm, finding that redemption. But her sacrifice forces leadership onto the least likely candidate.
Ginevra, the assassin.
Ginevra. The killer who just wanted to get paid, who actively despised most humans, is now holding the incredibly dangerous Lotus Scepter and is effectively the leader of this group trying to save the world.
And the threat isn't over. Pelagie is still out there.
Not only is he out there, he immediately hires help. A professional killer named Selek Enda, a dragon hunter.
A dragon hunter. So he's specifically targeting Vizen.
Seems likely. Or at least anyone associated with the dragon who now guards the people holding the Lotus. The chase is instantly back on.
Okay, let's pull back and summarize the key takeaways from this whole arc.
Well, we saw our journey start with a simple heist, right? Retrieve the Lotus. But it blew up into this continent-spanning defense against an elemental threat, all because of one man's, Bishop Pelagie's, corrupt ambition and his really reckless use of dangerous magic tech.
And the Locum Varnarium, the living armor, is a stark warning about unchecked technological development, how quickly it can go wrong and corrupt even good soldiers like Gauvain.
Definitely. And then there's Lisette's story. Her life was defined by banishment, by lost honor. But ultimately, she finds redemption. Her final act shows that real honor isn't about titles. It's about, you know, having the strength to protect others, even if it costs you everything.
She really did restore her legacy in the end.
A powerful end. But it leaves things incredibly precarious.
Which leads us to that final provocative thought for you, the listener. Think about this. Ginevra, the assassin who measures success in body count, now holds the Lotus Scepter, the very artifact amplifying this world-threatening corruption. She's only just started to maybe see value in anything beyond killing.
And the person hunting her is Selek Enda, a professional killer whose specialty is taking down dragons, her most powerful protector, Vizen.
So the question is, does the world now face a greater danger from these accidental heroes, led by an assassin wielding immense power she barely understands, than it did from the calculated evil they just managed to thwart?
That relic in those hands, it really makes you wonder. The fate of Edea is now balanced on the edge of an assassin's blade.
Something to definitely mull over. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.